So we're all good. Guys at the back, welcome everyone. My name's Chris Auld.
Hey, I'm Dave Shorter.
We're from sunny Intergen. I'm from sunny Rotorua.
I'm from rainy Auckland.
So this session is about document database, Azure Search, and polyglot persistence in Microsoft Azure. Who can tell me what polyglotism is? Yeah, so it's sort of derived from this idea of sort of multilingualism, kind of being a polymath in languages. And so it's really all about this idea that when we build these cloud-based apps, rather than just sticking data in one place, we actually sort of chop our data up, spread it around a range of different databases based on the capabilities of those databases. Who can tell me who this guy is? Fowler, it is Fowler. Who said that? Well done, that man. Absolutely, that is Martin Fowler. And his famous book is what book? Well, the really famous one. Design Patterns, exactly. So the current one is NoSQL Distilled. And he sets out a pretty good case of this idea of polyglot persistence. Snap up the QR code if you want the link. Which is all about how we can take advantage of the various capabilities of different data stores inside our application. And it becomes really easy once we're working in the cloud because we can go and buy all these things on an as-a-service basis. You notice you get basically everything as a service these days, right? Databases as a service, platforms as a service, backend as a service, blah 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 blah. So what are our options in Azure? We have SQL Server and a Windows and an IaaS VM, right? You know, so SQL Server is still going to be part of pretty much every application that you build in some way, shape, or form. So SQL Server and IaaS, basically installing SQL Server into a VM. We get a fully featured relational database. We get, you know, full ACID transactions. We get rich querying. We get rich programmability, blah-de-blah-de-blah. It's a relational database. No one loved it for years. At the other end, we've got things like Windows Azure Storage, blobs, tables, queues. Right? Far more sort of simple storage, but some interesting characteristics in terms of, you know, it's entirely managed as a service. It's very elastic, right? So we only pay for what we use, and effectively we've got unlimited capacity on tap. It's got a schema-free data model. You'll know what the data looks like before we get started. So we can chuck any old data into that store. And then in the middle, we've got these sort of hybrids. You know, Windows Azure SQL Database is bringing those relational capabilities into one of those sort of managed elastic services. And DocumentDB, so has anybody played with DocumentDB yet? Two or three? Cool, so DocumentDB is a document store database, a JSON store database running as a service in Azure, and it probably brings some more of the classically relational characteristics into the NoSQL store space. So as we go through today, you'll actually see a whole lot of things. Or if you've come from a relational background, you'll go, actually, you know, that's really useful to have. And if you've played a lot in NoSQL already, you'll kind of go, yeah, I really missed some of these characteristics when I moved to NoSQL databases. So we're going to talk a bit about an application that Dave built that actually shows some of this stuff off.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. Everyone knows AdventureWorks, right? It's been around for a while. We've taken AdventureWorks and put some different storage options behind it. So I was just going to go through those quickly. We've got an e-commerce website sitting in Azure websites. We're using Azure Search to provide, you know, a real rich search functionality that we've come to expect. We're using DocDB to store our customer records, our product records, and things like foreign exchange. And we're using Azure SQL to store our transactional data so that we can, you know, get nice, strong reporting from it. Table storage we're using for our shopping cart and just a simple key value pair. That's kind of the wraparound.
Yeah, so it may be a little contrived, but showing that, you know, actually you can take a whole lot of these different services and sort of bolt them together to produce something that's pretty neat, but also it's pretty neat in terms of our ability to just scale it up as we want to go, you know. So I mean, there's nothing in here that really is complex to scale. It's just, you know, literally turn the dial.
Cool. Sweet, so just going to have a quick run through. So this is the home page. We've got some, you know, rich search like we talked about. We've got completion. We've got some highlighting. We've got search results coming up. So see all the products related to Mountain, which we searched for. We've got some category information on the left-hand side there. We can, and this is all surfaced out of Azure Search.
Anyone ever had to build an e-commerce site? Who's built e-commerce sites? Really? Am I the only one? I built it on Classic ASP, but I guess that still counts. I think it's still running. You built yours in Perl. Oh, here we go. There's always someone who'll bloody lay down.
Cool. Once we drill down into a product, we're servicing the data straight out of DocDB. So that's JSON from the server straight to the client.
So what are some of the nice things about DocDB that we can sort of see on this page?
Some of the nice things, you know, doesn't matter about the schema. So you see on the right-hand side we've got specifications, and that's coming straight out of straight from a JSON format.
Right. So the thing that really appeals to me, everybody familiar with those specifications there, right? That really appeals to me is that they can all be richly typed. So, you know, if you think about how you do that in relational land, you'd probably build some sort of, you know, you'd denormalize it and probably drop more into strings and things. Actually, these can all be strongly typed values, right? So they're stored in the database, hierarchically in the document as strongly typed values, and we can pluck them out with queries later on. So that's kind of neat. Schema free.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so from there we can add it to the cart like we talked about and check out which pushes it to SQL.
Groovy. So, we'll start by talking about DocumentDB. So DocumentDB has been announced as a service for about 3 weeks. So this session had a kind of weird title at the start of sort of the tech ed sign-ups before it was announced. And it is a JSON document store. So it basically stores, indexes, and provides a query mechanism for JSON documents. Does anybody not know what JSON is? It's a room full of cool kids. Awesome, right? So, there's some really cool stuff we can think about when we think about JSON, because that potentially says, hey, we could store our data in JavaScript, maybe manipulate our data and application in JavaScript using, say, Node on the server, and then push JavaScript down to the client side and, say, use, you know, an MVVM, MVC type pattern down there. So this means there's some interesting opportunities in terms of really speeding our development process and narrowing the set of languages that we have to use. And there have been JSON document stores for a while. The challenge has always been that you often make a whole lot of sacrifices to get to take advantage of them, right? In terms of, you know, how do we query them? How do we interact with them? So Azure Document Database provides server-side programmability. So if you're a server-side programmability person, stored procs, triggers, UDFs, all that sort of carry on, DocDB allows you to execute JavaScript inside the database engine on the server side within the scope of an atomic, consistent, isolated, and durable transaction, right? Which is kind of neat. So it means that we can take advantage of, you know, that programmability to reduce the number of hops we have to make back and forth to the database. It has tunable consistency. So one of the characteristics of these NoSQL databases is that we use replication to create multiple copies of our data in order to ensure durability, right? But also in order to ensure that we can scale out, right, once we're beyond the read load capacity of a single node. To do that, we need to make some decisions about how do we do that replication, right? Do we want to be guaranteed consistent the moment we write the data, right? I write the data to the database, and all three replicas are consistent, or am I happy to say, no, I write the data to the database, and as long as at some point we get back to consistency, I'm happy. We can tune that in order to tune our performance and our durability. And it's fully managed as a service. So basically, you rock up, hand over your credit card, and, you know, off you go, $22.50 a month as your starting point to buy this thing. And you get a whole lot for $22.50 a month, which I'll show you shortly. So in terms of how it works, it is a RESTful service. Right? So REST, basically, we call URIs with given HTTP verbs, and that basically performs actions on the resources at those URIs. It's pretty simple in terms of you're calling it, handing up JSON payloads. That means you're going to be able to interact with this thing from pretty much anything that can do HTTP, that can manipulate some JSON, can do some basic math to be able to do things like signing off the requests. There are libraries already for Node, .NET, JavaScript, Python. You said there are a couple more coming.
Yeah, a couple more. So C and Java.
C and Java.
Underway.
There's some limited JavaScript stuff at the moment. But again, you know, anything that can do HTTP is going to be able to talk to Azure.db. So you end up with this sort of set of resources that you deal with, each of which is uniquely addressable. And it's those resources against which you're making those RESTful service calls, right? So if we want to deal with a document, right, we're going to do things like put, patch, post, get that document. We use collections to partition this for scale out, right? So we basically partition our data into collections, right? And that provides our mechanism to scale out to support more throughput. And then within each collection, we replicate the data multiple times in order to ensure durability and availability. We've got granular access control permissions, right? So all of these resources have permissions set for them. And there's quite a neat thing for managing attachments, right? So we can actually attach files into our documents, right? So big binary files, and rather than storing them within .db, .db will actually manage handing those files off out to Windows Azure Blob Storage and will manage the life cycle of those attachments. Right? So if we delete the document, .db will also go and delete those attachments out of Blob Storage. So we get the advantage of nice, cheap storage, right? But we don't have to faff around and write all the code to manage the life cycle. So, quick show and tell, eh, Dave?
Yep, cool. All right, so, yep, sweet. To get started, so we go to the portal.
Ooh, hello. What happened
the
there?
The black portal.
Of course. You've gone to sleep, mate. You've gone to sleep, mate.
I'm going to have a snooze.
Have a snooze.
Sweet, so we pop into the portal. What we need to do is obviously give our database a name. At the moment, there's only one pricing tier, which is standard, so it's pretty sweet. And we can specify some capacity units, which Chris is going to touch on later on. Cool, so once we've done that, we'll get a key out. So let's pop over to Visual Studio and see how we use it. The first thing that we need to do is reference our .db client libraries using NuGet, currently in preview. Cool, so let's quickly go through what we need to do to get some documents in there. So we can crack open a new document client. We give it our endpoint and our auth key. We define our database, which Chris touched on before, and then we create our collection, which sits within our database.
So everything always lives within a collection, right?
Yeah. Alrighty, so I've got a couple of JSON files. So one of them is the tracks here at TechEd. So at track ID, name, and description. And the other one is a list of sessions. So session code, name.
That looks like a good session.
Yeah, should we go to that one?
Yeah, we should go to that one.
Okay. Alrighty, so we've got some speaker user IDs here, which is obviously a collection that you can see, and we've got location. So we'll use those later on in our queries. Alrighty, so to get these documents in, obviously, we read our file in, deserialize them, and just iterate through what we've got and create documents. It's easy as that.
Yeah, so the neat thing here is we are actually squirting nice, tight, we can squirt tight JSON into that create document if we want to. So we can work with everything typed, and then we just squirt those typed objects straight at .db, and it persists them for us. All right, and when it persists them, indexes them, and we can query them back out, which is pretty neat. And again, you know, everybody sort of thinks of these NoSQL servers, oh yeah, it's all about, let's do massive scale and we're going to take over the world and the biggest startup in the world. And actually, this just gets you up and going really, really quickly, right? You're going to have to sit, you're going to have to go out for like a dozen coffees to argue about which ORM you're going to use.
Yep.
Right? Anyone have that problem? ORM arguments?
Who's had an ORM battle?
An ORM battle? Who's had ORM battles? ORM battles? Yeah, there's always ORM battles. He says, what the hell are you talking? Object relational mapper, right? You guys are too new school.
Cool. One other thing to call out is using DocDB, we also get concurrency. So we've got we can use our e-tags to, if Chris modifies the session so that he only wants to talk to it, and I try and do the same at the same time, it's one of us is going to win.
So it's optimistic concurrency, just like Azure Storage, yeah? Is that us?
Yep.
Yeah. All good. Okay, so we can get data into our database, piece of cake. Getting the data out is always good fun. As soon as you run at any sort of scale, you've got to have some sort of indexing mechanism in there, right? And where were the Couch and Mongo people? Indexing. How easy is indexing? Yeah, not very easy. That was, I won't repeat that one. Right? Indexing is bloody hard, and indexing is also really interesting, right? Because I've got the schema-free database, and schema-free is the future, and now I need to do some indexing. What do those indexes do? Well, they kind of imply a schema, right? So you're schema-free until you actually want to get data out, and then you're not schema-free. Right? So DocDB indexes your entire document tree, all right? You don't have to do any secondary definitions, no faffing around. It indexes the entire thing. And those indexes use a log structure merge mechanism to basically maintain good performance under heavy write pressure. And then we can query that back out. Ultimately, the queries funk down into a language that's represented as sort of Java trees, so JavaScript trees to the engine. But there's a SQL-like wrapper that wraps around that. So it means, for people who are coming from a SQL-type background, you are literally querying this thing just like SQL. All right, so here are some simple trees. The example we've got here is just a simple predicate query, select star from company C, where C.headquarter equals Belgium. Super, super easy. There it is in JavaScript with anonymous functions. And then we get the results back. Remember, those results can come back, right, as a hierarchical tree. Right? Whereas if you're in SQL land, the results you get back are rectangular. Right? So you get a whole lot of crap back, often if you've done lots of joins. Pretty good. Subqueries, so we can run subqueries within a single document tree, right? Effectively almost joining a document to itself to pull out certain portions of the tree. And we also have user-defined function support. So that means we can write a user-defined function in JavaScript, and we can call that user-defined function as part of our queries. Should be very familiar to SQL people, and something that is kind of neat, right, when we start thinking about how do I reduce those round trips to the server. The biggest thing about programmability in Azure DocDB, right, is that it's going to let us reduce round trips to the server. Right? Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, very expensive. Right? The most expensive part of building applications these days is waiting on that network latency. Right? So by having some programmability, we can actually do some stuff on the server in terms of reducing the number of calls back and forth.
Alrighty. So let's have a look at a couple of queries. So again, we're using our client. So we go and grab a document client. We look up our collection, and then we can start doing some queries. So you'll see here we're using a link lambda syntax. We're using our POCO object called session. So I've gone and created that based on the JSON that I've got back. And we can do some filters where the session code is equal to this one.
Have you just given us a schema?
Yeah, actually I have.
Right. So at some point, you're probably going to end up with a schema, right? But you don't have to have one. Literally, we can just grab the JSON, paste it into classes, and we've now got typed objects to work with.
Cool. And obviously with this syntax, it's familiar. It's how we deal with collections all day, every day. So it's easy. There's no learning barrier there. It's very familiar. Alrighty. So the next one. Next one, we're still using our POCO session object, but we're using our SQL syntax. So again, very familiar to the data guys. We can go off and get all of our sessions and find out find them where our sessions are compulsory.
Which is what, just this one, yeah?
Just for us. Cool, so if we have a look at the results of that, the compulsory sessions are obviously Tech Live, the happy hours, and closing drinks, which is it's pretty good, isn't it? I'd go to that. Alrighty, now we get to a little bit more interesting. So instead of using our POCO session, we're returning a dynamic object. But like Chris talked about, because we're storing JSON documents in our document database, we can traverse the tree. So we're not restricted to tables and columns equivalents in SQL. So here we can go to our sessions and we can return, you know, the sessions locations room name and the session locations building.
That was the time to clap. Right, so it is quite a different thought process to what you do with a relational database, right? Where everything, you know, effectively all of your relations are separate and you kind of sort of bolt them together at query time. The document database, everything sits in that single document tree, right? Because you are usually dealing with everything within that tree in your operations.
Cool, so this next one, a couple of new things. So like Chris talked about, we've got a join. So we're joining within our document. So that's the first important call out, is that we can't join off to other documents. We're joining to a collection within our document. So if you remember sessions, we had a collection of speaker user IDs. And so we're joining to that and filtering where the speaker is 3025. The next thing we're doing is we're building up our result set. So you see we can... give our results names and we can use concatenation to combine things up to suit how we need.
So we're basically building our own little bit of JSON and sort of string manipulation, right?
Yeah. Yep. So it looks like Chris is speaking at architecture this afternoon as well. Plug, plug. Alrighty, and the other thing we can do is perform calculations. So if we had totals or subtotals, we could add those up or work out the subtotal from GST and lines.
I think the key thing is it should be very familiar if you are coming from a relational background. Who are the couch people? How do you query couch? No. Who likes MapReduce? I like MapReduce. No, okay. Okay, so those little bits of math at the end give lie to the fact that actually there is a code execution engine sitting within DocumentDB. That code execution engine executes JavaScript, and that JavaScript can take the form of stored procedures, triggers, and user-defined functions, all of which should be familiar concepts to you if you are from a relational background. That JavaScript language execution is integrated within the database engine. So it means that it is wrapped within an atomic transaction. And if you throw an exception in your JavaScript, the engine will roll back the entire transaction. Now, it's really important to get clear what you're getting with transactions here. What you're getting is transaction scope within a single call to the database server. So what we can't do is like go, you know, call up to the server, say begin transaction, run a whole lot of crap, right, and then go, you know, roll back or commit. Right? What we do is we make a single call to the database server, that starts a transaction, right, and we can run some JavaScript up there, perform multiple operations, change multiple documents, and then we either return successfully from that and commit, or we throw an exception and that will implicitly roll back that transaction. Your JavaScript code is sandboxed, so you can't go and do imports. Anything that you need to reuse has to come in via cut and paste. The eval function is disallowed. Your execution is time boxed, so you can't go up there and compute pi to a million decimal places. Probably not a good idea. And you are resource governed. And we'll talk a bit about the resource governor later on. But for the most part, you know, this should be pretty simple, pretty familiar to people who are used to writing a bit of JavaScript and working with SQL Server.
Cool. All right, so here we've got we're defining a stored procedure and we're loading up some JavaScript from a file. We create it, again, it sits within the collection.
So this is that resource model, right?
Yep. Alrighty, and then to execute our stored procedure, we just what you call client execute, and we pass our link to our proc, and then any parameters that we pass in. So let's go and have a look at what this guy's doing.
Yeah, I was going to say let's look at the procedure.
Yeah, read my mind. Alrighty, so the first thing you'll notice is at the top we're passing in session code, a session code. So down the bottom, the first thing we're going to do is go and load up all sessions for that session code, which we expect to get one back. The next thing we're going to head up to is go and load up all of our tracks, and that's going to load up the whole collection. So then we're using the stored procedure to effectively grab our session and join off to our tracks and only return the related tracks. So this is giving us the loose join, effectively. Cool. Alrighty.
What's that context?
It's a good segue. Alright, so we've got this context object, and it's provided to us by DocDB. And that context object gives us access to the collection that we're running in, or the request that's come in, or we can set the body on the way out. So what we can see here is, in this context, we're getting the response and we're setting the body ourselves, and that's what's giving us the result of the stored proc.
And have you ever seen a database that looks like a web server? Does this look like a little bit like a, you know? It's again, if you're a web person, this is probably familiar to you, right? You know, so lower learning curve, faster time to deliver your solutions.
Cool, so there we can see we're returning the single session for the code we passed in. And the track. Stop clicking. Alrighty. So the next thing we've got is a trigger. So there are two types of triggers. There's a pre-trigger and a post-trigger. So the same as SQL. There's a pre-trigger and a post-trigger, and they occur when you insert or update or delete documents. An example of a pre-trigger might be if you want to do some validation on your schema, or you want to do some...
What?
Yeah, no, I was waiting for... expecting an elbow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to do some validation, or you want to, say, turn things to capitals or something like that. So here we're using a pre-trigger to go and stamp a last updated field onto our track.
I think what we did in AdventureWorks is much more kind of in the whole polyglot paradigm. So what we did in AdventureWorks is we actually use a trigger to drive background processes. So basically you go and you'll update a document, and we want a whole lot of stuff to happen in the background. Actually what we want to do is we want to push that data off to the search service that we're going to see later. And of course we can't make external calls off the box here, right, out of the database server in JavaScript. So what we're doing is we write out to effectively a journaling table, right, within that trigger, and then we monitor that journaling table and use that journaling table to go and push that document across to the search service, which means we have what sort of consistency? Eventual, right? At the end of the day, pretty much everything's eventually consistent because there's 2,000 milliseconds between the web server and your customer, right? Everybody gets some of their knickers in a knot about consistency levels. Everything's eventually consistent, it just is, you know, a varying time bounds, and we'll talk about some interesting time bounded consistency shortly. Sorry, I went off bloody script.
That's all good. So again, we're using the context object here. So we're getting the body, we're updating, we're adding a last updated field, and then we're setting the body. Alrighty. So when we're writing a document, we opt in to using the trigger. So you can see here we're creating the document, we're passing in some options, and we're adding a pre-include trigger of the trigger that we've just created.
So we have to opt in to receive that trigger?
If we want to do it, yeah.
Okay.
And it's one thing to call out is the triggers have a type, so whether they're good for creation, deletion, updation, all of them, and if you mix them up, then you'll get an error back. Alrighty, the final thing that we've talked about is user-defined functions. So these guys are a little bit different. So we don't have access to the context object. They're just for compute only. So an example of what we're using it for here is to pass in a date, go through and work out if it's occurred yet or not. Pretty easy. Excuse my JavaScript, but if we were able to use something like Moment, or it would be a lot easier, and we can do that, like Chris mentioned, by creating a different function, copying in Moment, the Moment code.
Yeah, so really important, you can't just go and include stuff from wherever you want to on the web. Everything has to come in and be stored as a resource inside DocumentDB.
Cool. All right, so these guys are accessed, not explicit, not using the client, so, sorry. We don't call these explicitly like we did for stored procedures. We use them within our SQL syntax. So here you can see we're going off and getting all of our sessions, and we're passing the session start date in and returning the result into a have I missed it column. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a bit about consistency. So I hinted at this earlier. So all of these, you know, pretty much all of these NoSQL type databases use a data duplication replication mechanism in order to deliver better throughput, better availability, and to ensure durability. So basically, every time we have a piece of your data, we store it multiple times within the data center. Consistency talks to how that data is updated across those replicas. So when we talk about the idea of strong consistency, it means that when Dave makes a call up to the database server, and that call successfully returns to the client, if it is strongly consistent, that data will have been written to sufficient copies, sufficient replica copies, to ensure that when we go and read it in a strong fashion, we get that value back. Right? So if we write the value foo and we immediately re-query, we get the value foo back. Now, it's not always writing to all three copies. Right? And the reason for that is that we don't need to get consistency. Right? So Azure SQL Database, sorry, Windows Azure Document Database will give you strong consistency by doing both quorum writes and quorum reads. So basically what it'll do is when we write, it'll write to a quorum of replicas, and then when we read, it will ensure that it gets the same value back from a quorum of replicas. So we've got three replicas, we write the value foo, it gets written to at least two synchronously, and then we get the return, right? And then we go and read, it goes and starts reading, gets foo from the first one, great, gets foo from the second one, great, I've now got a quorum, two of three, I can now return to the client. Right. So that's strong consistency. And we can tune this consistency level, because you can imagine, right, those synchronous calls go across a network, they can be expensive. We may not want to pay that performance cost, right, because we may be prepared to sacrifice, you know, some of those consistency guarantees. So the way you tune consistency with Azure Document Database is you specify the default consistency level at the database account level, right? And then you can weaken that consistency level on a per query request. Right? So you can never weaken the write consistency, but you can weaken the read consistency. And it offers four levels of consistency. So we've just spoken about strong. Right? It has another level of consistency called bounded statelessness. Bounded staleness. And bounded staleness basically lets us do a query and specify how out of date we're happy to allow that data to be, but we're still guaranteed to get things in order. Probably the more interesting one is this thing called session consistency. So session consistency is basically read your own writes. This one's really useful because, you know, often you'd be happy to accept eventual consistency as long as you don't confuse the user, all right? So if the user's getting phantom reads, right, the user will get confused. If we give the user guaranteed reads, it actually doesn't matter when all the other people looking at the same piece of data see it, as long as our session gets read consistency. Right. So that's a really, you know, good option, is to be able to use session consistency. And then eventually consistent, right? So eventually consistent is, you know, we write the data, all of the updates to the replicas are propagated asynchronously, and a reader can go and pull data off, off any one of those replicas. So that's always going to be eventually consistent. Does that kind of make sense to people? Do people get the benefits of, you know, being able to tune this consistency, right? You know, because it's you're saving yourself a whole lot of, you know, a whole lot of time on that request if you can manage to avoid another synchronous hop off the box to another node. So I talked a bit earlier about this idea of indexing. And I think probably among all the things that DocDB does, the indexing stuff is kind of the coolest. So it uses a log-structured merged mechanism to build those indexes. And I am not going to go into the details of LSM indexes today, but if you sign up for the Azure Conf, the online Azure Conf, that's going to happen in like October-ish, I think. I'm going to do a deep dive session where hopefully we'll start to talk about some of that sort of stuff. If you want to geek out on it, go to research.microsoft.com and go poking around in the database research. At a high level, it's really good and well optimized, right, for working with SSD type storage, and it's heavily optimized to be able to continue to deliver good performance under really heavy write pressure. By default, yes. So key value stores are a type of database. So the key value stores are a little different. So I mean, if we take an example of, say, Windows Azure Table Storage as a key value store, that really only has a single index, right? It indexes your partition key and your row key. And actually, one of the pain points, who's experienced that pain, is you can't add any more indexes. This is effectively, you know, usually you come to the session and you say, we index everything, right? And it's awesome. And then like some like Greg Lowe or one of the database geeks pops up and says, yeah, but what happens when you rebuild the indexes, all right? Or someone says, you know, someone who knows about B-tree indexes, which is the classic indexing strategy for databases, goes, it's going to really suck, right? Because indexing's is a trade-off, right? Indexing is trading off, typically, even with this, write performance versus read performance, right? Because when we write, we're writing not just the data, but going and updating all the indexes. More indexes, slower writes. More indexes, faster reads. Right? Got to get that balance right. Yeah. So, by default, everything is indexed. And by default, this thing works pretty bloody well. Right? And that's that whole get-to-market quickly idea. If you want to, you can further tune those indexes. So you can choose to make your indexes lazy, right? Effectively, you can make your indexes eventually consistent. If you make your indexes eventually consistent, you've basically said the whole bloody thing's eventually consistent, right? Because when you query, you're going to be using the indexes. So the size limit at the moment is 10 gigabytes per collection. So if you've got 1 million customers and you're storing just classic customer data, that'll handle it more than easily. So 10 gigs actually gets you a whole lot of space. There are a few sort of caveats to that in terms of throughput that we'll talk about shortly. But that is the limit at preview. As a given collection is no greater than 10 gigs. We can choose to include or exclude specific paths in our index, and this all happens at a collection level. Right? So really important that there's no concept of tables in Azure DocDB. Right? So you don't go and set things on tables. Things happen on a collection basis. So, you know, and a collection is not necessarily a bunch of the same looking stuff. So we can include or exclude specific paths. So you could say, actually, I don't want your stinking indexing everything. Index nothing except that path, that path, that path, and that path. Right? You can choose to use either hash or range indexes. Who wants to tell me, who can tell me why you'd want one over the other?
Speed.
Yep. Tell me, where would you use hash indexes?
When you want a key lookup.
When you want a key lookup, exactly. And when would you use range indexes?
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, if your queries are likely to pull a range of records out at once, right, range index is good. If your queries are likely to pull a single value out at once, hash indexes are good. And we can also adjust the index precision, right? So that's really how far into the data value the engine's going to look, and specifically how far into the data value the engine is going to store in the index. Reason being, you want to focus on that is you're paying for the index storage. Right, so sure, we can go and index all 250-odd characters, but actually, you know, you probably only need 3 or 4 characters. And again, what you're trading off there is storage space versus performance, right? Particularly if you've got things that are, you know, sort of quite densely packed at the start of the value. Don't dismiss classic index tuning things that you might like to do. For example, flipping values around, right? You know, haven't got a lot of entropy in your key space, right? Because everything starts with the same characters, reverse it, right, and have the index pick it up that way. Is that making sense to people? If you haven't got entropy, then your index is as good as useless. Right? So you can either increase your index precision, i.e. capture more characters, or maybe just dupe that value, flip it around, so that you've got a nice, noisy, the tail end of the value, lots of entropy, index, crackerjack. Indexes. Take my money. Take it now. In preview at the moment, 50% cost discount. That doesn't always double at GA, but I think $22.50 and also $45 is pretty good value. So basically you are buying a bucket of storage and a bucket of effectively CPU query request processing. And though that request processing is measured in a thing called request units per second, you're getting 2,000 request units per second. And basically what you then need to do is you just buy additional capacity units as you go. 10 gigabytes of database and 2,000 request units is a lot for many applications. Why is that? So these request units are basically the way that we meter how much load, how much throughput you're putting on the database. And you consume those on a sort of a per second basis. So if you've got 2,000 request units, you can do 2,000 reads of a single document by ID during 1 second, right? With session or eventual consistency. You can do 500 inserts, replace, deletes, 1,000 simple predicate queries, 20 stored procedures that within the stored procedure update 50 documents. You kind of go, how the hell do I work all this crap out? Every time you make a request to Azure DocDB, one of the response headers you're going to get back is x-ms-request-charge, which will tell you the number of request units that particular request consumed, and you just need to work out how many of those are you doing per second. Useful to go and look at that limits link, because there are some additional limits on collections. In particular, there's a limit of 667. Don't know why they picked 667. Request units per collection. All right, so when you buy your standard consumption unit, capacity unit, right, you're getting 2,000. So you effectively you're going to need to spread that across 3 collections to really be getting your money's worth, because the maximum throughput you can pull out of a single collection is 667. Guess I just wanted to use 666, right? Someone said, oh, I'll make it 2/3. Oh, no, maybe not. We'll round up. Okay. Any sort of quick questions on DocDB? Look interesting? Yeah? The thing is, it's That throughput is pretty cheap, right? That performance is actually pretty cheap. If you come to my session, the Sava, we'll talk about where it stacks against, you know, other storage options. The biggest benefit of Azure DocDB is that fast time to market, right? This ability to really quickly build these solutions, right? Because you can just squirt your JSON straight into the document database. You know, you can pull it out easily. You don't have to faff around with indexing and so forth. So, you know, fast time to market is a key value there. How's it throttled? Yeah, so it will send you back HTTP error codes, and you know it's just the standard back off retry approach. So you'll need to take the standard back off retry approach that you have to do in any cloud-based application, right? Everything gets throttled in Azure. SQL database gets throttled. Azure storage gets throttled. This gets throttled. So all of your applications need to be doing that, you know, back off retry logic. Yeah. Well, so that's the trade-off, right? The question is, you know, you're always kind of querying with schema in mind because you always, you know, you hope you think you know what's in your database, yeah. Right? The biggest benefit of this is that is change over time, right? You know, the biggest sort of luxury you get with these schema-free models is that the data model can change over time, and you never have a hard change in your data tier. You know, if you think about, say, running a SQL database, you have a point in time where you go from schema V1 to schema V2, right? Whereas in this, your data model can evolve over time, and you can accommodate for that in your code, right? So you never actually have to change the data model in the database itself. Well, if you say something that doesn't exist, you're not going to get any documents back, right? Yeah, and exactly. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Not if it's part of a predicate. Yeah. Question at the back? Not that I'm aware of at the moment. So to do that, you'd need to probably just capture that request charge. That's kind of your sort of golden value. It's the one you want to know all about, all right? Because that's the one that's basically costing you money. So let's talk a bit about search. So Google, Bing, bless them, have made users accustomed to getting really nice, really capable, rich text querying engines at their fingertips. So you go and build your application these days, and you're expected to have a nice, rich search engine. And those are reasonably hard to do. That's right, mate. So Azure Search provides a cloud-hosted search engine that allows you to do some of that rich searching over the top of documents, again, over the top of JSON documents. There's quite a bit of overlap between these two services, right? You know, and that in some ways they look very, very similar. At a high level, again, it's a HTTP-based API that you can use to create indexes over a set of documents. You can then search that using keyword-type searching with the common operators, you know, bracketing, wildcards, includes, excludes, that people are used to. It provides a hit highlighting mechanism. It provides a faceting mechanism. So if you're familiar with, remember down the side of the e-commerce site, there are those, you know, mountain bikes, 26-inch wheels, 27.5-inch wheels, 29-inch wheels. That's faceting. Suggestion, so autocomplete. So if you spell like a Muppet like me, it'll provide suggestions. And then an ability to provide some additional filters on top of those text queries. And the last couple of ones that are probably more sort of advanced topics are it has a sort of a scoring mechanism that you can use to boost results based on sort of various parameters. So, you know, a good example would be, say, contribution margin, right? If you're an e-commerce retailer, you might actually boost search results. So when you search for mountain bikes, you're actually going to boost the results and give you the ones with the highest contribution margin first, Right? If you're a little more ethical, you might say, actually, we'll boost the results based on which one's the highest rated first. And that's quite sophisticated. Like, you can sort of define certain boosting curves and what happens, you know, accelerate that end of the continuum. And it also has geospatial support. So, you can do things like query to find all the products that are within, that are at stores within 10 kilometers of where I am. Or find me mountain bikes, but actually for scoring, rank those, right, by which ones are closest to where I am, which is kind of neat. Pretty simple, we define a schema, and we insert that schema into Windows Azure Search, and that includes things like the fields we're going to index, the fields that are going to drive our scoring, and any other fields that we might want to use just for things like sorting, filtering, and so forth. And then we populate the index, we just push JSON data into Azure Search. And so again, in our AdventureWorks scenario, what we do is every time we go and update a product document, right, we actually do that background updating mechanism to go and push that data into Azure Search. So again, you know, if you do this, you are pretty much always accepting a degree of eventual consistency in your application design. There is no pull mechanism yet, so there's no crawling capability at the moment. You have to explicitly push that data as JSON formatted documents into the search service. Over to you.
Alrighty. I wonder if we just start looking straight at the searches.
Yep, good,
cool. Alrighty, so as Chris mentioned, we've got the ability to suggest results. And so what suggest does is effectively like a type ahead. So if we search for mountain here, we're hitting the suggest endpoint, which we can see up there, passing in a partial mount, and we're getting results back from mountain. Now the other thing which the suggest endpoint does is it will, like Chris mentioned, if we've got some bad spelling and run that, we're still going to get results back. So search service is going to interpret this fuzzy parameter that we pass in and do some character replacement for us, which is pretty cool.
And you'd probably call that asynchronously from that text box, yeah? So as we were typing in that text box, actually in the background it's going and calling this asynchronously,
yep,
and getting suggestions as we type. You know, tough stuff to go and have to build yourself.
Cool. So one of the other things that we get out of the search service, like we saw in AdventureWorks, was highlighting, and pretty easy. All we need to do to enable that is pass in the highlight keyword and pass in the column that we want to highlight. So down here you'll see how we've got some search highlights, and it'll return, you know, some context of where it's found the word that we're searching for. And then we will get the results as well. So we can do multiple highlights if we add in description. Again, we'll get name and description back. There are a couple of other search things that we can pass in, so top, count, skip, and obviously there's, you know, a good use of that is pagination.
That'd be a really cool feature in document database, pagination. Sorry, that was meant to be a
joke. Get on the user voice and suggest
it. I could, yeah. So there's no pagination currently on document database. If you want pagination, how would you probably solve that? Who said that? Out. Out. No. That's the joke I was trying to raise, right? Because the Raven guy has gone off and done a great big blog post. Oh, woe is me. How would you do it? How would you do it? Oh, I'm off script and I'm putting you on the spot.
You'd use search server, surely.
You just use a stored proc, right? So you basically use a stored proc as effectively a parameterized query, and you do all of your pagination, right, on the server side, right? Because you wouldn't want to have to go back and fetch. Just pass the parameters into a stored proc, off you go, right? beauty of having code in the database server is there's kind of this escape hatch for everything, because we can always code our way around missing features. Sorry, off script again.
No, that's all good. All right, so one other thing to call out is that we get the search score back with every result. And so, like Chris mentioned, with the scoring, every index has a default scoring profile, and that's what returns our search score back. If we don't explicitly say we want to order by something, that's the order that we're going to get it back. Righty. We've also got the ability to construct OData expressions as well by using the filter tag. So give us a bike where the price is less than $400 and the color's yellow. Is that one for you?
No. I bet my wheels are less than $400. But they are yellow.
Cool. So the other one that we've talked about is faceting. So we can pass in what field we want to facet on. So here we've got manufacturer, and that returns us back the results, the count of the results and the value.
So this is how you build those nice filters down the side, right? You know, when you go to the online web store and you do the sliders to say how much am I prepared to spend, what colour do I want, what manufacturer or brand, so on and so forth. Faceting is the mechanism that does that. Again, rather than building it yourself, faceting comes out of the box here.
Cool, and we can facet by multiple things as well. So here we're faceted by manufacturer and colour. There's also a few other parameters that we can pass into facet. So if we only wanted the top two facets of manufacturer, we could do that, and that's ordered by count. How are we going for time?
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Let's skip scoring for the moment.
Yep.
We'll talk about scoring. Right. So, we've basically done these, haven't we?
Yeah.
Searching, we did highlighting, we did filtering, we did sorting, we did paging. Talked briefly about projection, basically the ability to just pull certain properties out of our document when we return them. We spoke about faceting, and everybody kind of groks the count. Those filters are defined as OData expressions. Doesn't support the complete OData syntax, but they're working towards it. And it's those filters that you'd use for things like pulling data from the facets and other sort of refiners that you might apply to your search. Those filters support geospatial stuff. So we can insert geodata, JSON-defined geodata, into the search service inside our document. And then we can do search based on point distances, but also based on containment there. All right, you know, so you get things like that first query, which is find me stuff within 10 kilometres of this point, or find me stuff that is bound by this polygon, which is kind of neat, just comes to you out of the box. So search ranking's pretty important. There's a really big company that's made a whole lot of money out of having what they think is a pretty good search ranking algorithm. So if you're doing anything where you've got lots and lots of data, you're going to want to have a mechanism to tune, tweak, and customize that search ranking mechanism. So by default, Azure Search uses effectively words and keywords and so forth to rank your results. But you can then go and customize that using what we call scoring profiles. And scoring profiles, basically, you do a bunch of things. You can change the column weighting. So you could say that with our mountain query, for example, I'm more interested in keywords being in the title than in the description. Right? So it would find bottle cage, right? Our mountain bike bottle cage, and it would rate that ahead of, say, mountain bike washing fluid with the description as this stuff comes in a 750ml bottle. Right. It's going to change that ranking. Freshness, so if something's got a date column, we can prioritise and give a boost to newer or older data. Distance, so again, obviously we've got those distance-based queries, but we can also use distance for boosting our search results. So we naturally boost results of nearer places than further places from you. And if you ever, anyone use Yelp to find good Japanese restaurants? Yeah, so all of those sorts of services, they do geo-boosting. And then magnitude. So if you've got a numeric column, say a rating or say a contribution margin, you could use that to boost the results as well. Okay, shut up, Chris, and take my money. So how do you buy this? You buy what are called search units. And this is a little interesting in that you can apply those search units either to partition out, i.e. to have more documents and more storage, or to replicate, i.e. to be able to deal with more throughput and have more HA available. All right. So as long as this is rectangular, you could have three search units stacked up like this, right? Which means you've got three replicas, you're trying to get more query throughput. Right? You could say, actually, I'm going to have four stacked out like this. What am I trying to do there? Store lots and lots of documents, but probably don't have a huge amount of query throughput. Each search unit has a specific capacity, about 15 million documents, 25 gigs, and a throughput of roughly 15 queries per second, which is not heaps, given that you're going to pay $250 per unit for them. So it's reasonably, I think it's reasonably expensive, but actually it's something that's pretty challenging to go and build yourself. So you just need to look at it and go, you know, if I model out my app, roughly how many search requests do I think I'm going to get per second? 15 is probably still a lot in terms of the number of users you've probably got on your site at any point in time. Don't have the trade me guys tell us how many queries they get a second? No. more than 15, I'm assuming. Yeah, there we go, more than 15. Okay. Or you can scale out, right? As long as it's rectangular. There's some free stuff. You can get a free tier, right? That's got 50 megs of storage and 10,000 documents. So you can kick the tires on this thing for free. That may be enough to, it probably is enough to deal with a small site. That AdventureWorks site would probably all fit inside that free tier. So don't completely discount this thing if you're at the small end. With that, we will take questions. We are all at stands between you and lunch, but we will take questions. Just stretching? There is no free tier for DocDB at the moment. No. That's $22. It's kind of like a few coffees. No, so the question was, can you kind of like save up your request units? No, I mean, one of the things, and again, come to the session this afternoon, we talk about sort of reserved capacity and pay as you use it. One of the things when you reserve capacity is you've basically got it on a use it or lose it basis. Because if Microsoft's got a server sitting there for you and you're not doing anything with it, right, you can't stack that stuff up. It's like, people's time. Right? If it's reserved, it's just that throughput. Any others? Thank you all for coming along. And we'll see a bunch of you at the Intergen booth later today or over lunch.